Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. The conservative legal commentator Walter Olson explains why almost every Republican judge involved, all the way up to the Supreme Court, voted to dismiss Trump's ridiculous lawsuits to overturn the election. And then the journalist Lindsay Beierstein will tell us about Passages, a brutal release program in Montana for women convicted of trivial crimes, an obscure corner of the American carceral state that embodies its full brutality. Before that, some words in the economic news. As I've been saying for a few weeks, it's looking like the recovery from the depths of spring is running out of steam. First-time claims for unemployment insurance, a sensitive and timely indicator of the state of the job market, has been declining from incredible heights reached in March and April. The peak, almost 7 million applications in the week ending March 28th, was 10 times the maximum recorded since the series began in 1967. They fell by around 90% to just over 700,000 in early November, but they've been creeping higher ever since. Last week, they came in just under 900,000, which, while a lot lower than 7 million, is still a third more than anything seen before this pandemic. 5.5 million people are drawing benefits under traditional state programs, and another 15 million are drawing benefits under programs expanded by the CARES Act, which, among other things, extended coverage to freelancers and others not included in traditional programs. Unless Congress does something very soon, these will disappear at the end of this month. Other signs of increasing trouble come from the Census Bureau's experimental Household Pulse survey, taken every 2 weeks. It showed a decline of 4 million in the number of people reporting themselves as employed. These figures do bounce around, but this is not the direction we want to see them bouncing in. The survey also found 27 million adults saying they sometimes or often aren't getting enough food. That's 13% of the population, up more than 7 million or 5 percentage points from pre-pandemic levels. These astronomic pandemic numbers obscure the fact that even in good times, 1 in 12 Americans has trouble getting enough food. Between late August and early December, there was a rise of almost 7.5 million in those reporting themselves finding it somewhat or very difficult to pay their bills. Over that same period, there's been a rise of 6 million in those depending upon credit cards to pay their bills, a rise of 4 million drawing on their savings, 4.5 million borrowing from friends and family, and almost 2 million more relying on food stamps. And into this comes the expiration of the special pandemic unemployment benefits and the relentless spread of COVID-19. The vaccines will probably bring substantial relief, but we won't see that for some time. And a few words on our soon-to-be-departing president. From the first, I've been saying it's hard to think clearly about Trump. On the one hand, his hucksterism, bombast, bigotry, anti-intellectualism, and sleaze have deep roots in American political culture. On the other hand, he is a turn for the worse. It's hard to keep both those thoughts in mind at once. Lately, though, I've seen a few political scientists I like and respect downplaying the effect he's had on our politics. Despite his ignorance and pitiful attention span, he's done a lot of deregulating, especially on environmental issues, politicized previously technocratic functions and offices of government, fostered a mass and often armed movement of frenzied supporters, completely changed the politics of immigration, turned the GOP into a personality cult, given rise to a host of imitators at the state and local level, and transformed the federal judiciary in ways that will last for a generation. These are reprehensible, but not insignificant. Speaking of judges, the focus of my first interview, a New York Times study published the other day took the measure of Trump's impact on the federal courts. It found that his appointees were far less collegial than those appointed by his Republican predecessors. With previous cohorts, strong dissents along party lines were relatively rare. With Trump's appointees, and to be fair, Mitch McConnell's leadership of the Senate was an important contributor here, emphasizing strong reactionaries, now sharp dissents are more likely. I'm not saying that sharp disagreement is a bad thing. I am saying that Trump's appointees have transformed the judiciary, and since many of them are relatively young, they're going to be around for a long time. Somehow I doubt Biden would even try to appoint similarly sharp liberals, and in any case, McConnell would never allow the Senate to confirm them, assuming the Republicans retain the control of that body. Okay, now onto the interviews. First, judges. A lot of people, sometimes including me, were afraid that a gaggle of partisan Republican judges would rule in favor of Trump's suits to overturn the election. They didn't, and many of them wrote sharp rebukes of the strategy. Why? the question is especially intriguing in light of the wider partisan divide I was just discussing. It's a little odd to admit this, but long ago, when I was a freshman in college, I was a libertarian and a member of Yale's Party of the Right for a year or so. It didn't last, but during my membership, I got to know my first guest, Walter Olson. I've stayed in touch with him on Facebook because he's a thoughtful and principled libertarian at a time when the right gets dumber and meaner every day. I thought he'd be a good person to ask what drove those Republican judges to rule as they did. Walter Olson is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute, not your standard behind-the-news guest, but sometimes it's good to get out and around. Walter Olson. Some of us from the outside were looking at the legal decisions in the president's futile campaign to reject the results of the election, and saw a bunch of Republican justices, some of them nominated by him, rejecting his arguments brutally often. And certainly then the Supreme Court decision was also a surprise to some of us. What happened? I mean, I thought a lot of people figured that there would just be partisan Republicans who would decide with the president and we'd have a deep constitutional crisis or something, but that didn't happen. How do you explain what happened?
Well, in fact, the opposite happened, which is that, so far as I can tell, they did not get a single federal judge, whether he had appointed them or not, to rule on his behalf. A few state judges ruled on some intermediary issues, but basically he got cleaned out. 1-58 was the last score that I saw, and the one was a meaningless victory involving technical issue of a small handful of votes. It wasn't just that he lost before his own judges and before other Republican judges. It was that they were really clobbering him. They were writing pointed decisions which pointed out that he was trying to overturn the decision of the voters, which drew a firm line saying the courts are not going to be any part of this. And it was interesting the variety of ways in which this would turn up. One of the ones that was most closely watched was the Third Circuit from Philadelphia, in which they tried to appeal their loss, challenging Pennsylvania procedure and millions of Pennsylvania votes. And that three-judge panel, which included a veteran, distinguished Republican judge, handed the decision over to the junior member of the three, who happened to be the Trump appointees, Stefanos Bibas, formerly a law professor at Penn and highly respected guy. And Bibas just, you know, stepped up and, you know, gave the occasion what it deserved in a very eloquent decision saying, you know, in this country, the people rule. I'm paraphrasing, but basically that. And then if you go down to Georgia, that federal case was appealed to the 11th Circuit, and they drew what some must have imagined to be a dream panel for Trump. I forget who the third judge was, but the two that I recognized were Bill Pryor, who has been on Trump's shortlist for nominations, but is generally considered too conservative to get confirmed, and Barbara Lagoa, who was the one who got furthest for the seat that Amy Coney Barrett was picked for. She was essentially the runner-up. So he got those two, and once again, whap, a wooden plank against his forehead. You know, the very firmly written decision, leaving no room whatsoever for the thought that they might have won by arguing a little differently. And so when it got to the Supreme Court, we already had seen a bunch of these, and I had myself written a piece, I guess a week earlier, although I've been talking this for more weeks than that, saying I predicted the Supreme Court would not even take up, let alone not rule in his favor, but wouldn't even take up his challenges, which is so far what has happened with both of them. The Pennsylvania one that appealed from the Third Circuit, and the ridiculous one from Texas. I'm sorry, they're all ridiculous, but the extra super ridiculous one from Texas, if we can invoke comparatives here. So when it got to the Supreme Court, you will see some back and forth discussion of, well, did he lose 2-7 or did he lose 0-9? I'm pretty confident that he lost 0-9.
What were those two about?
I'm delighted to talk about it. I don't know if it was too much into the weeds, but I'm happy to go into it. The Texas suit was very unusual in its format in that it was a state versus state suit. There aren't many of those. And under the terms of the Constitution, you can file those directly in the Supreme Court, unlike the great majority of federal suits, which have to percolate up through the trial and appeals courts. State versus state suits, you can file directly in the Supreme Court. And they don't get many of them, as I say. And the law is not entirely settled on some pretty basic issues because they get so few of them. And one of the topics that's been debated for years is when a state brings one of these petitions to file, when it has to ask permission to file rather than filing as a right, does the court have to give grant it at least the right to file? Do they at least have to open the door and you know, see what it is? And the majority of the court has held for a long time, no, we can turn it down without even reaching that point. Alito and Thomas have taken the minority view, which a lot of respectable scholars do. It is not particularly an ideological question. You have to at least open the door and let them file, even if you immediately kick them out for filing a stupid meritless lawsuit. And this has come up a couple of times earlier. The most colorful one was when Oklahoma and Nebraska tried to sue the state of Colorado for legalizing marijuana back when Colorado was pioneering that. And I mean, just to describe the suit is to say how stupid it was. You know, states maybe can sue each other for tearing down a dam that releases a flood that goes into their territory, although the Supreme Court also just turned down a water case between Texas and New Mexico. But it certainly was not going to take on the merits this stupid case saying that you violated the rights of Oklahoma by legalizing marijuana one state away. And yet, Alito and Thomas in that case said, no, we need to at least let them file. Ilya Soman, a law professor that I follow closely, has gone into the Colorado case in particular and has said that if you look at what Thomas and Alito have written about federalism issues in other cases, he thinks it's very clear that, like the other seven, they would have kicked Colorado, or they would have kicked Nebraska and Oklahoma out instantly on the merits. They, you know, they would have seen no merit in that thing. So it really was sincere. You know, they believe that that's how you have to read the relevant clause of the Constitution. So all of that was prologue. As the Texas case came in, knowledgeable people like Steve Vladeck, the law professor at University of Texas, who is a specialist in this so-called original jurisdiction, the specialized set of cases that the Supreme Court hears this way. He said, look for Alito and Thomas to go off on their own thing, which doesn't mean that it has any implications for any of the other issues of the case, like whether Texas has standing or whether it would be entitled to any of the remedies or whatever. And that's exactly what happened. And they used some language that you can argue over when they said that they would not grant any other relief. Most people, including me, see that as saying, look, on the bottom line of whether Texas is going to get any sort of court order from this court, no, it is not. And we just wanted to signal that so that there's a little more unity. Another important clue is that they did not call it a dissent. A dissent would be the ordinary way of describing it if you want the outcome to come out differently from what the majority as voters do. Instead, they styled it as a statement. Again, this is minor. It's just a matter of wording, but court watchers rightly find it significant. They were not signaling a different outcome. They were signaling that they wanted to hold that issue to keep arguing in future cases.
Okay, so now the question that many people on the left are asking is, why didn't they vote more along partisan lines? I think a lot of people were genuinely surprised that all these Republican justices behaved in such a principled fashion.
Well, and there's several things going on here, and I was not surprised, but I realize it's going to take some unpacking as to why people like me and most people I know were not at all surprised who watched the court from a standpoint more content with the majority direction of the court these days. And part of it is, I'm just going to start right out and say life tenure. Life tenure makes a huge difference. If you want to know why the states were a little more wobbly, he didn't win anything in the states, but there were more judges that were more kind of mealy-mouthed about turning down his claims at the state level. There were more dissents that would at least have let his claims get somewhat further, although I still don't believe that there were any members of state Supreme Courts who said that they actually would go through with it. But he got a more weak and mealy-mouthed response in the state courts than in the federal courts. The state courts, of course, not only don't have life tenure typically, but also the judges will frequently come up for election, depending on what state you're in. So right then and there, you have one of the important observations about the American court system, which is the federal courts have a different culture from the state courts. State courts look over their shoulder at politics. Either they have to run for re-election or they had to run for election on a partisan line in the first place. One way or another, they are more worried about things like money being deployed to kick them out at the next election. They are more worried about people knocking doors against them. And we can go into some of the past examples of Roe's Bird being recalled in California and so forth. But there's a number of influences. And money is not, I would say, the most important one that state judges probably had in mind here. The fact that the Trump constituency makes life hell for people who have to run in Republican primaries may be a more relevant pressure on Republican elected state judges. All that having been said, let's turn to the federal one. So you start out with life tenure. You then have the general elitism of a process that only has a few hundred federal judgeships to hand out and tends to save them for highly credentialed, highly known quantities. Process doesn't always work. Some bad federal judges get through, but by and large, there is a lot of quality control. You know, if there's a bad senator, some doubtful choices can be made because senators play this unusual, unwritten role in getting federal judges their seats. But by and large, you have a self-consciously elite group when you have the federal courts and the communities that surround them, and that's part of what you should keep in mind when you talk about the conservative legal community, is that for every one conservative judge, there are dozens of clerks or dozens of others who have in some way or another kind of invested in, we have wonderful judges. And there's peer pressure in a way that there is not political pressure. They do worry about what other judges think of them. They worry for the direct practical reason that getting reversed a lot or getting en banc'd a lot, which is what they call it when your circuit decides that you've flubbed something and they review it and change the outcome. This is actually one of the big reputational hits that federal judges can take, is to be reversed or en banc'd too often. And so there is this group sense of, I want to be respectable to my peers, including across ideological lines. This very much is something where liberal judges mostly behave as if they value the respect of their conservative counterparts and vice versa. So it affects how cases are written, but it also affects the positions they're willing to take. And judges knew, I think in their bones, that to endorse most of these silly Trump claims was to be a laughingstock. And they don't have to care necessarily whether they're a laughingstock when they go out grocery shopping. They've got life tenure. But imagine having life tenure and being locked in a room with highly intelligent people who are snickering at you for the rest of your life.
I'm speaking with the legal analyst Walter Olson at the Cato Institute.
The Federalist Society plays a role in judge selection these days. A lot of people on the left have a notion of the Federalist Society as a giant conspiracy of Opus Dei and the devil, I guess. What role did the Federalist Society play in the creation of this conservative legal culture?
Well, it has played an important role. I don't think anyone would deny that it's played an important role in pulling together a conservative legal culture that would undoubtedly have existed to some extent anyway, but the Federalist Society provides the structure of lots of meetings, lots of chapters, and annual conventions at which, if you are a judge who is recognized as being more or less on the right, and particularly if you are a good writer and able to hold your own intellectually, you will get invitations to speak on the panels. You will become something of a rock star for lawyers and law students who have come out to see that panel. So it creates more of a sense of a formidable audience that you want to impress with good work. And of course, it also provides personal networking of a sort that lawyers love. You know, this is a very important part of the legal profession, that networking is an important way to advance. And the critics of the Federalist Society often overrate the extent to which getting to become a judge is the lure of people going out to Federalist Society meetings. I would say a majority of the people know perfectly well that they're not likely to be to wind up a judge or don't have that as their career ambition in law anyway. However, they do think it's neat that if they keep going to Federalist Society meetings, they will meet people who will probably be appointed judges, not necessarily in their own state, but yes, maybe in their own state. The networking is quite tantalizing, and the intellectual content, and this goes for lawyers who are like most lawyers early in their career, often going to be stuck at a large firm doing fantastically boring work that pays the bills. The Federalist Society is an intellectual outlet, which is often their way of keeping up on constitutional law, their way of keeping up on developments in the law generally, is because the Federalist Society will always be talking about whatever interesting trends are going on in the law. Now, one other thing I should throw in here, although I'm not sure it played much of a role in this particular episode, is that the Federalist Society has said from the beginning that it was a group for conservative and libertarian, unquote, law students, law professors, and lawyers. Its origins, of course, were in law schools. And by putting in that and libertarian, they did set the tone on in a certain number of ways, which is that people expected to go in there not for unanimity, but for difference of opinion on a wide range of issues. Now, from a left perspective, the differences between conservatives and libertarians are not all that important on tax issues and regulatory issues, although they make it more so. So you may think, well, what does it matter? On the other hand, as soon as you turn to a lot of other issues, whether it be criminal law, where Federalist Society has always had a lot of people who are strongly interested in civil liberties and criminal defense perspectives on things, or on how to approach religion and the law, again, always a lot of libertarians who believed in neutrality and disengagement as a way of approaching the law and religion nexus. You find that it's not coincidence that some people call it a debating society, because for a lot of conservatives who didn't have anyone to argue with in the rest of their lives, they go to the Federalist Society and there's going to be someone teasing them for being too libertarian or too traditionalist or too whatever. Nowadays, maybe too national conservative. And so, again, in this particular case, there was near unanimity in that you could take some of the most libertarian members of the Federalist Society or some of the most religious ones, and they would all say that, this litigation is frivolous, it's ridiculous, get it out of here. There are only a couple of exceptions I can think of. Unfortunately, a pretty big exception is the dean of Chapman Law School, John Eastman, who has been on the Federalist Society circuit and who popped up supporting the Texas case. But again, overwhelmingly, you would find that this was not a matter of factional differences within the Federalist Society. They would all recognize on the law, on the application of past cases in the form of precedent and accepted constitutional principle, that the Trump administration lost 59 times because it was 59 different varieties of wrong. It was just wrong every time because it didn't have the facts and it didn't have the law. And the few instances where it had any little bits of law were typically very minor cases which weren't going to affect any outcomes. And so in order to build this barrage of litigation, which had to present itself in such a way that it might involve large enough numbers of votes to actually change the outcome in one of the five or six states, they had to go beyond the very small ball things where they might have had a little bit of a case and go into ridiculously overstated and large claims. I don't know whether this is a good time to talk about some of the additional problems. I mean, that when I'll just mention that in the Wisconsin federal case where they drew a Trump appointee, unlike most of the federal judges who threw it out at an earlier procedural case before really reaching the merits, and that led to enormous discontent in Trump world about, they won't let us present the merits. Well, this judge did it differently, even though he probably recognized that he had lots of reasons to throw it out at earlier filter stages had he wanted to. He said, no, come on in. Give me your best facts and give me your best legal theories, and let's see if we can't resolve it on the merits. Well, this was the most embarrassing of many, many embarrassing moments, perhaps, in the entire episode, because presented with the opportunity to finally file their substantive case about voter fraud, they had nothing. You know, they didn't have a two of diamonds. They stipulated to the same facts that the state agreed to, which facts involved there being no proof of voter fraud. So that's what happened when they had to finally put up on their all of their talk of voter fraud in one of the six states. And likewise, they had no good legal theories, so he was able to proceed to simply kill the suit on its merits.
Which were non-existent.
Well, right, on its non-existent merits. I mean, he basically said, you know, go ahead and serve me your main dish. And then he pulled up the silver platter cover and you know, there was nothing, not even, a dead insect. There was just nothing at all. So, you know, people are kind of psychologically satisfied with that, because even though it would probably have been better judging to throw it out on one of the earlier grounds like standing, people are still kind of satisfied that there is such a final answer to the Trump world claims you never got to the merits, and so maybe our merits were fine.
I'm speaking with the legal analyst Walter Olson at the Cato Institute. Okay, and then that David French article, which you posted to Facebook and got me thinking about all this, he says, you know, the disdain for the conservative elite legal establishment for that kind of Trumpy litigation may not last if the party gets further Trumpified and the conservative movement gets more so. What do you think of that risk in the future?
I think that's a very serious, very important point. And I know that a lot of people who know more about it than I are also concerned, because you know, one of the first things, if you follow a lot of Trumpy accounts, and I still do follow some of them on Twitter just to know what they're thinking, within hours, sometimes within minutes of the announcement of the Supreme Court would not be hearing the Texas case, you had high follower accounts who are paid attention in Trump land saying, next time, whenever it is, we need to change judicial selection. The Federalist Society has sold us out. And you, these articles are now beginning to appear around Trump world. The Federalist Society stabbed us in the back. It's the James Madison equivalent of the Doxos legenda. And we must never let this happen again. We must appoint judges who understand the political realities that we're in a war. They sometimes use phrasing like wartime conservatives versus peacetime conservatives, and they were already on the verge of dismissing the Federalist Society as peacetime conservatives, and now they definitely will, which is that these are conservatives who are too bound up in the, and they will even sometimes say bourgeois, but to, I mean, such is the horseshoe theory, you know, such is the extent to which they are trying to remold themselves after what they perceive as the success of the left, that they will identify the influence of business class and of property owners as having imposed this bourgeois rule of law overlay that has now tripped them up in an unexpected and potentially lethal way as far as Trump's hopes of staying on. But of course, they believe, and it's not completely imaginary, that Trump could be around in 4 years, that politics could somehow allow him to get back in. And so they are saying, you know, the people who have been in charge of judicial selection over the last 4 years must not be allowed back into it. We need people who are loyal. And there is a wider strange story about this, which is that Trump would wait until the last couple of months of his administration to replace the head of various Pentagon offices, heads of Homeland Security offices, and now with Bill Barr departing. I don't think he's actually going to have time to put in someone more loyal than Bill Barr. But in a lot of cases, including even Bill Barr, who has gone farther toward accommodating Trumpism than I would ever want someone to go, but Bill Barr nonetheless, in various ways, stuck to the accepted culture of the Department of Justice. He did not reveal certain investigations that Trump would have wanted revealed for political reasons until their time came. He stated frankly that they had found no evidence of voter fraud at a time when that was the last thing Trump wanted to hear from his attorney general. So, you know, I know that your show has discussed this ongoing issue of the extent to which Trump is and is not like certain European leaders of the 20th century. And one of the curious things is that he wasn't putting the totally ruthless and loyalty-oriented subordinates in charge of some of these extraordinarily important branches of his government. And I think all bets are off if he gets back into office. Because the longer he goes, the more it tends to be a matter of personal loyalists rather than people with an independent claim to head a cabinet or a department or whatever the job is.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine anybody would want to go work for him with any kind of reputation would want to go work for him now. I mean, look at the clownish lawyer team he put together.
Well, Trumpism is a popular phenomenon, and it's you can see that in the ungodly amounts of money donated to his legal effort. Of course, they were not spending most of it on their legal effort, or else they would have gotten better lawyers. But nonetheless, there is genuinely a mass following out there that can do a couple of important things. And one of them is they can kind of keep your career going for years based on, if you've seen how many dozens of otherwise thoroughly mediocre people have large social media followings and TV shows on admittedly not the best cable outlets and so forth, but nonetheless enough so that they can go out and sell books and charge for appearances and do the various other things needed to keep going in that particular space. This is not something where someone is pulling strings. The left has had this sort of explanatory theory of, well, the right goes on because, certain super billionaires are giving donations to make things happen. Trump world is not like that at all, even though it does have some major donors. A great deal of it is a mass movement in which people respond to the voices that give them what they want to hear. And parting from the Trump administration on seemingly decent terms, even if they weren't really all that happy with it, but being able to say that you were a former Trump official, it is an entree into for people who might be obscure otherwise into being surrounded by adoring fans. And potentially having a lot of people willing to give money, grassroots, small donations money. And so you say, well, who would want to go work for Trump World? If you're saying who among the best-known lawyers of their generation would want to, well, yeah, it's a good question. Why couldn't they get anyone better to argue their cases? It wasn't just because political pressure was being applied to a couple of the few firms that had handled some of the more meritorious matters for them. It was truly that people did not want their reputations associated with that litigation. But others were willing to step forward. And sure enough, Sidney Paul and Lynn Wood, who were already fairly well-known figures in Trump world, are now super celebrities in Trump world who can make a lot of things happen just by tweeting something.
Conservative okay. Movement that's come a long way since 1971.
Oh, has it ever? I would never predict where it's going next.
I was Walter Olson, a libertarian legal commentator and a fellow at the Cato Institute. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Thank you. That was some of the third movement of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 30, performed by Mitsuko Uchida. Beethoven's presumed birthday was December 16th. I say presumed because only the date of his baptism is known, the 17th, but the practice in the Bonn of his time was to baptize infants the day after they were born. This isn't just any birthday, it's his 250th. Frequent listeners know I'm rather fond of old Ludwig. Next, an obscure corner of the American carceral state. Passages, a pre-release house for women prisoners in Billings, Montana. It's not really a halfway house, it's a somewhat milder version of a prison. After doing most of their time, typically the prisoners are released to the custody of this institution, where they're forced to find a job, pay their way, follow lots of rules, and run the constant risk of being returned to prison. The journalist Lindsay Beierstein looked into it and wrote up her findings for Vice. Here she is to brief us. Lindsay Beierstein. The American carceral state has so many grim dimensions. This is one I hadn't really thought about before. What kind of facility is this?
Pre-release centers are institutions that are designed to be kind of a waypoint between prison and regular life. And people go there as sort of a step down from prison, but they're not like halfway houses. Like if you picture a halfway house, you sort of picture a ranch house somewhere in the suburbs with 8 or 10 people and 3 staff members. It's not like that. It's like a no security prison. It's kind of got a security level, kind of like what you would expect from a TSA checkpoint if they also did urine drug screenings. There are no visible guns. There's no barbed wire. It's a converted hotel, the one that I went to, out on the south side of Billings, Montana. And there are about 75 people in the pre-release program at any given time, plus more people on the detention and assessment floor and more people on the drug treatment floor. So it's an institution that has over 100 people and a couple dozen staff members at least.
And who owns these things?
They're private nonprofit corporations. So they're all under contract to the state of Montana's Department of Corrections. And the pre-release that I went to is owned by a company called Alternatives Incorporated that also runs a facility for men in the same city and supervised probation and bail services and ankle monitors. They've got a whole bunch of different sidelines going on. But it's a fairly small operation. It's not a giant interstate correctional compact or anything like that.
And is it mostly drug offenses or other kinds of things too?
It's a lot of drug stuff. They're all nonviolent, whatever Montana's definition is of that. So I talked to people who had drug offenses themselves, one woman who got busted for having drug paraphernalia on her way to visit somebody else in prison, somebody else I knew met that was there for some kind of reckless driving. Usually pretty low-level stuff.
The things that should be barely a criminal offenses, if at all.
Exactly. I mean, half of the stuff I don't think should even be a crime. I mean, I don't think it should be a crime to possess drugs or use drugs or even sell drugs.
What's the typical path here? You do some time in prison and get released to a place like this?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, there are different ways in, but for the most part, we're talking the women in the pre-release program are people that were at the Montana State Prison for Women, which is about 3 blocks away. And then they go to the pre-release, and the amount of time you spend there varies depending on how quickly you can complete the program, but it usually takes over a year to work your way through it. And what happens is they bring you there, and you're expected to, you start with no privileges, so you're essentially confined to the facility, and you have to use this sort of behaviorist ladder of reward to get more and more freedom. But the most important thing you have to do is you have to go out and you have to get a job. And so your work, if all goes well and you do manage to get a job, you're trying to live as a low-wage worker in a city that's not very friendly in terms of transportation.
And you have to find your own job. They don't find one for you?
Well, they help you. They have a thing called Job Club, and they do teach you some things about how to look for a job. They've got a room full of really old computers, and they teach people how to do online searches and look at job boards. And then they also have relationships with a lot of other businesses in the community, like restaurants and the local sugar refining plant and all kinds of different outfits in the community that have relationships with passages and let them know when they've got openings available. So these women are a stream of very docile, low-wage labor. These are people that literally have to show up for work. And it's interesting, there are a lot of rules of passages, a lot of gradations of rules from the most trivial, like a candy wrapper on the floor, not making your bed, all the way to the most serious stuff, like assaulting a staff member or selling drugs inside the facility. And one thing that struck me when I read the manual was that in the very top tier of rules was striking, organizing a petition, or any kind of protest is on the same level as assaulting a staff member with a weapon, in terms of what the punishment is going to be.
That's remarkable. But I was, you know, at first thought, oh, do employers want, you know, ex-cons? But then if the penalties for not behaving on the job are so severe, I guess it's a great deal for the employer.
It really is. And I think these women, I think the employers, I talked to some people that employed women from Passages and some local businessmen and stuff who were on the board, and they really like it. And I think these women do a really good job. I mean, the women that I met are really smart, really hardworking, you know, the kind of people that you would want to have as employees. So I'm not surprised that they're pleased between that and the horrible consequences for any kind of misbehavior.
So what's your day like in this joint?
You wake up, you have to make your bed, you go eat, and then you either go to work or you go to job club, I think, if you're in the pre-release program. And if you have, and then you have to come home, and then you may or may not have passes to go do some things. So you might have a pass to go for a 45-minute walk along a pre-selected route, or you might have a pass for 4 hours on the weekend to go to the local Walmart, which is the main place where people buy their necessities. And you have to buy almost everything. Passages supplies nothing to you in addition to charging you for room and board. You have to pay for laundry. You have to pay for detergent. You have to pay for, if you're not paying it directly to Passages, you're having to buy it yourself out of your meager wages, basically.
And you arrive without even a toothbrush, right?
A lot of the time. I mean, if you're coming, if you're, say, a probation violator or something like that, you may be able to bring in a very carefully controlled inventory of stuff from the outside world. But a lot of time, people just show up with nothing.
And then you're expected to buy all this stuff for yourself on, what, $11 an hour they're paid?
I think the minimum wage in Montana is a little bit less than that, but the average wage that people get, and I think that's because, you know, there's some people at the higher end who are pushing up the average. You know, some people actually are able to get a job at the sugar factory, which pays, you know, slightly better wages compared to what you make working at the Pita Pit or Denny's or something like that in town. But yeah, on somewhere around $8 an hour to $11 an hour, I would guess. And like all the stuff that you have to buy for your rehabilitation at Passages, the most onerous thing is the drug treatment component of it. That you can be assigned to go and spend 90 days in drug treatment, which is their third floor, which is a locked floor upstairs. And you have to be paying, you know, your room and your basic $15 a day room and board, plus paying for your workbooks, paying for supplies, pen, paper, whatever, to do this drug treatment thing. So when you start with 90 days of drug treatment, you start $1,400 in the hole when you go down to pre-release.
That's remarkable. You have to pay room and board. I know this, like, what do they call it, offender-funded justice is all the rage now, but it's remarkable you have to pay for your confinement.
Yeah, it's statutory, too. It's not just what Passages decided to charge. There, it is actually written into the law that people have to be charged this much per day for these services. And you're being paid while you're being punished, too. So say you break a rule and you have to go up to the second floor, which is another locked unit, which is basically like jail, but with absolutely nothing to do. It's just sitting in this tiny hotel bedroom. But you can't lie on your bed. You have to sit and be doing something approved. It drives people absolutely insane. People get suicidal in this space. But you're paying your room and board for that. So you're adding to the debt that you have to pay off before you can graduate from the program for your own punishment.
Yeah, I was looking at their webpage, and they said they have all these kinds of therapy that you're supposed to go through. Among them, dialectical behavior therapy and moral reconation therapy. What is this?
Dialectical behavior therapy is actually a real thing. It's developed by a professor out at the University of Washington. And it's one of the only things that's empirically been shown to work on people with borderline personality disorder. And it's actually kind of cool. I don't know. I have no idea. I never got to see any treatment at Passages, so I don't know what the quality of their DBT is, but it's premised on unconditional positive regard and acceptance of all of these people's range of extremely volatile emotions. And if it's done properly, it can be really good. I don't really know what moral reconation therapy is, but I suspect it's some kind of moralistic pseudoscience, honestly. Some kind of, you know, medicalized shaming.
This is an enterprise of moral renovation.
Exactly, where they rub your face and what you... This is my assumption, because I haven't looked into what their program is, but I've looked into similar kinds of programs, and it's very often a kind of just, you know, it's trapped up and it's dressed up in the trappings of psychotherapy, but it's really about, you know, rubbing your face and what you did wrong and why you're a bad person and why you should apologize and why you should feel bad and have a debt to society that you need to pay and, you know, the whole bit.
Well, and then I think one of the people on the staff told you that the system was unpleasant by design.
Yep, ahead.
Yeah, that's remarkable. I mean, you know, I guess that's American carceral philosophy in a nutshell, but it's...
Yeah, he said they want to discourage people from coming back there.
How do these inmates balance all this? I mean, the work, it's really hard to get around the city, so there's not much in the way of transportation. They're under all these time schedules, and then the requirements of the therapy and all that. How do they manage to juggle all these things at once?
It's extremely stressful. And people say, a lot of people told me they would just rather be in prison than in this program, because you've got all these demands of work, of all these kind of mandatory meetings and therapeutic stuff that you have to do, even if you're not on the treatment floor. And then there are all these rules about transportation too, because in order to be allowed to pick somebody up at the pre-release, you have to have licensing. If you're an outsider, a friend, a family member, whatever, you have to prove that you have your license and your registration and be on file with Passages as a designated person who can pick people up. And a lot of the girls I talked to said, I don't know anybody who could do that for me. Like, I know some people with cars, but none of them could actually produce the documentation that Passages would need. And Passages has this whole fleet of monogrammed vans sitting out in the parking lot, but they don't have any staff time or refuse to delegate much staff time to drive people places. So you've got women walking to these meetings at the local church or whatever through really bad neighborhoods alone at night, or walking to work at 3:30 in the morning to go, fire up the grill at the Billings Clinic a mile away. And the weather in Billings is horrible. It gets freezing in the winter and extremely hot in the summer, and people don't necessarily have appropriate clothing for it. I talked to a bunch of friends and moms who had bought winter coats for either for their daughters or for friends of their daughters, because they just didn't have appropriate shoes or coats to be walking around in the snow in Billings in the middle of February.
And then, of course, there's this penalty structure if you break the rules. Like, you get locked in the locked room, but then you can go back to jail, right?
You can, if you wash out of the program, essentially, you can go back to prison. And there's something in the handbook about how you can be sent to the county jail for misbehavior, and you will be charged for it. That was the dubious part, was that you will also be charged if you go to jail. And it's like, how is that possible? The jail is paid for by tax dollars. And I never really did get a clear answer on how often that happens, or whether anybody's ever objected to it, because it seems bizarre to me that you could charge someone to go to a public jail.
Passages is on contract with the State Department of Corrections, right? I mean, there's public money there, too.
Absolutely. And, you wouldn't be charged for any of this stuff if you were in the state prison three blocks over, except maybe some of the sundries and snacks and whatever, you could buy from the commissary, but you wouldn't be charged for sanitary pads, or you wouldn't be charged for laundry or anything like that.
You're making minimal but wages, $8 to $11 an hour maybe, and then you're charged room and board, and you have to buy all your stuff. So what is the balance of income and outgo?
People are supposed to be able to save up enough money to pay off, after they pay off their drug treatment and their any restitution that they may owe, they're supposed to be able to save up enough money to put a deposit on an apartment, usually in the Billings area, which is a really overheated housing market right now. So it's a tough thing to do. And they used to have this thing called the Transitional Living Program, where you would be living in an apartment and still responsible for going back to Passages for security check-ins, which was just the most onerous part of all, because you'd have to be shuttling between your house and the facility and work, instead of just going between work and the facility. And it was just onerous. But the state canceled that last year, so people don't have to worry about that. That once you're out, and you're just a free person. You're usually going out on probation of some sort, but your sentence may have elapsed, and then you go and live in the community.
How common are these? Are there programs like this around the country?
There are. I found pre-release centers in about 6 or 7 states have some number of them, and the federal system also has them. But in Montana, they're much more central part of the criminal justice system than anywhere else that I found. It's a much more common thing for people to be sent to a pre-release. It's written into the law as to, a thing that happens to you when you commit a crime, that judges are very much, it's not just an experimental program or an option that a judge could send you to. It's like one of the main things on the menu for people in the system.
And do the inmates feel, when it's all over, do they feel like they get anything out of the experience, or is it just a big pain in the ass?
Mostly just a big pain in the ass, I would say. I mean, occasionally there are people who said, one person said, God bless the woman that gave me grief counseling. Vicky was amazing. She actually listened to me and helped me deal with the death of, and then she rattled off 4 or 5 family members who had died in the preceding year. And it's like, the system sent me here for drugs, but what was really my problem was overwhelming and untreated grief, and this woman actually listened to me, and it actually made a huge difference. So that was one positive thing. There was very little other positive stuff that anybody had to say about the experience, to be honest. And a lot of people said, you know, this could be a good thing. Lita Pepion, who's one of my main sources for the story, she was like, you know, I could see how this could actually be supportive and good because these women do need structure. These women do need supervision. These women do need job and life skills. But what they don't need is this incredible amount of punitive stress. That if it was a bit more supportive and a little less punitive, it could be actually transformative and positive for people.
Yeah, you could imagine something like this being done humanely, but that this is not that.
Exactly.
I noticed when I visited their website, there are a lot of big banners about COVID changing things. Have you heard anything about what COVID has done to pass?
They didn't tell me exactly what they did, but they did say that they have had a few cases. I'm kind of skeptical that they're really doing anything, just having seen the physical space and how tightly people are sandwiched together, that I would hope that the courts are just sending fewer people there so they can spread people out more. But when I was there, there were women sleeping, the sort of standard thing would be to sleep four to a, you know, Howard Johnson-sized hotel room, a converted hotel room. Hopefully they're spreading people out for, maybe giving people some hand sanitizer. I really don't know, but I don't see that they have a whole lot of options based on how that place is set up.
Yeah, that's a gruesome detail. It's a former Howard Johnson's.
With the car, you can still see the psychedelic carpet.
Oh my God. They didn't even change the carpet.
No, and they still have the breakfast bar and the Continental breakfast bar and everything.
That was Lindsay Beierstein. You can find her article on passages at vice.com. She did a podcast series for The Breach on Montana's treatment of drug use during pregnancy, not as a physical or mental health issue, but a felony. You can find that on the website of the Rewire News Group. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, more Beethoven, whose birthday I'm celebrating for the second week in a row, because he deserves it. This is some of the liberation from prison scene from Fidelio, his only opera, performed by the Chicago Symphony under Georg Scholte. As I said when I played this last year, it's a marvelous instance of an Enlightenment celebration of freedom, but the actual Enlightenment itself made some major exceptions in whom that freedom was for. Clearly, the only way that bourgeois society could live up to its constantly broken promises will require the transcendence of bourgeois society. Till next week, bye.